How many Americas is enough?
It is time to create one America, not two.
So says John Edwards as he endorses Barack Obama as the man to do it. There may be one America, but how many Democratic parties are there this morning? Uniters and dividers. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, May 15th, 2008. The former North Carolina senator has exquisite timing, taking the wind out of Hillary Clinton's big victory in West Virginia. Behind-the-scenes details coming up. Also, bad timing by the junta in Myanmar as 2 million cyclone victims desperately await aid. Slow progress in China, a fish story in Alaska, and posting or perish, who has time for the internet? That and all the news. At a rousing event in Michigan, the former number three Democratic candidate, John Edwards, gave his endorsement to the frontrunner.
Join me in helping send Barack Obama to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
Edwards told a crowd of several thousand that party unity is needed to defeat John McCain, saying the Democratic voters have made their choice and so have I. A campaign spokesman for Hillary Clinton says the race remains far from over.
More than 2 million people are on the verge of starvation, and Myanmar's junta announced today that its pro-military constitution has won overwhelming support. The junta, which is obstructing the delivery of international aid after a devastating cyclone more than a week ago, says turnout by voters was an astounding 99%. Nevertheless, Kyaw Tin Swe, the Burmese ambassador to the UN, says politics is not the priority of his government.
The main thing that is emphasized is that this is a humanitarian issue, and it must not be politicized. That is the view of everyone.
The UN is warning of a second wave of deaths in Myanmar unless the country's military regime quickly lets in more aid. Death toll could be 128,000. Heavy equipment has finally reached the worst areas of China, devastated by Monday's earthquake. State television has shown many rescue workers digging through the rubble of demolished buildings with their bare hands. After 2 days of refusing foreign assistance, China has agreed to accept help from longtime enemy Japan.
Congress passed the farm bill last night and also sent President Bush legislation directing him to temporarily halt oil shipments into the Strategic Federal Reserve. Lawmakers are hoping to lower energy prices. The president says the reserves do not affect prices and has refused to discontinue shipments of about 70,000 barrels a day.
After 100 years in the appliance business, GE has hired Goldman Sachs to auction off its appliance business as a way of dealing with profit declines that it reported in this quarter. Stocks start the morning higher. Oil is trading slightly down on world markets this morning. But our question for all of you relates to how much our lives have suddenly gone online these days. We simply want you to fill in the blank.
My day is not complete until I have done what online?
Until you've blanked online. And you can send your blank to 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.com. Or.
Julie in Basking Ridge, New Jersey says, my day is not complete until I've turned off the computer and sat down with my kids.
When I sit down with my kids, they have the computer on. That's sort of the deal.
Lots of good family time there for you, John.
Where do we have time for living online? That's what we want you to respond to. Much more.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. As we've mentioned, last night in my old hometown of Grand Rapids, Michigan, at a big event for Barack Obama, the candidate stepped up to the podium and invited the number three candidate, former number three, John Edwards, to the podium where he received an endorsement from John Edwards for Barack Obama. Covering the Democrats for Politico.com is Ben Smith. Ben, my conspiratorial instinct suggests that this was an endorsement that the Barack Obama people had in their back pocket for a while to pull off this perfect storm of timing in the wake of Hillary Clinton's victory in West Virginia. Am I wrong?
I think you are wrong, actually. I think it would have been nice to, I think the thing with this endorsement is they probably would have been pleased to roll him out earlier.
So,
he would have been very helpful to them in North Carolina, for instance, a couple weeks ago.
So what led up to this?
I think it's one of these things they've been working on a lot of people for a long time, and eventually it becomes clear to those people that Obama's the inevitable nominee and they want to get on the bandwagon. I mean, Edwards, it would have been also better for Edwards, I think, to have endorsed her earlier. Now it's really his appearance. He's just kind of, jumping on the bandwagon.
I mean, I guess what I'm wondering is, what is the horse trading that goes on in a situation like this? I mean, endorsements aren't clearly the most important events in any campaign. Nevertheless, there's all this behind-the-scenes negotiating. Who has the chips here?
Well, Obama has the chips, particularly now. I mean, Edwards could ask for more 2 weeks ago, could ask for more 1 week ago. He did get Obama to commit to this goal of his of cutting poverty in half in 5 years, which, I mean, I imagine everybody is for. But which is something Obama will now at least, I think, give lip service to. And who knows whether, there was some discussion of a job in the administration, which we don't know.
And that's not anything that you've been able to learn, right?
No, and the thing with if we don't know it and if it's a private promise, how do you hold the President of the United States to that?
Right. Now, I understand there's still some negotiating to do because perhaps Elizabeth Edwards isn't on board.
Yeah, she was not there in Grand Rapids last night and, in fact, has said very nice things about Hillary's health care plan. At one point, Edwards suggested he and his wife had voted for different people in the North Carolina primary a couple weeks ago, so now I think we know who voted for whom.
Well, theoretically, Edwards on the ticket suggests that the game plan for the Barack Obama campaign is all about reuniting the Democratic Party. Let's hear what Edwards had to say last night.
Brothers and sisters, we must come together as Democrats and in the fall stand up for what matters for the future of America, to make America what it needs to be.
Is this an astute move to advance that strategy?
It's where it's got to go. He in fact at length praised Hillary Clinton, which he was first booed by the crowd, and then, he's a very adept speaker and kind of warmed them up and convinced them to cheer for Hillary Clinton. That's kind of where this has to go. What Obama needs to do, because a lot of people are, half the party voted for Hillary Clinton, and so there are a lot of people who are unhappy that Obama's won.
Ben, quick question for you in terms of a practical matter. John Edwards did have 16 delegates. Obviously, he can't force them to support Obama, but he can certainly strongly urge them to, which can only be good for Obama at a time when the delegate race is so tight.
Yeah, that's exactly right. He's got, eight in South Carolina, four in New Hampshire. I've got that backward, and some in Iowa. They don't have to do what he says, but they likely will. And that'll really expand Obama's lead over Hillary.
Well, at the very least, it erases the sort of 12 to whatever it was in West Virginia, the delegates, depending on how that shakes out. So not only does it blanket the headlines from Hillary Clinton, it also tends to erase the delegate count from West Virginia. Ben Smith, thanks so much for joining us. Ben Smith covers the Democrats for Politico.com.
Today, aid agencies are warning of a second wave of deaths in Myanmar, putting the number of people at risk at 2.5 million. Among others, the UN is warning the country's ruling military junta it could be responsible for those deaths if officials continue to refuse allowing international aid agencies to assist. So where do we go from here? Jerry Woodrum is director of the U.S. campaign for Burma. And Jeremy, the news today is really not encouraging. We spoke to someone from the UN earlier who said they had 15 local workers on the ground in the southern part of the country that's been hit so hard. 15 people trying to help 2.5 million or more?
Yeah, it's a complete disaster and a total debacle. You have 2.5 million people facing death from disease. come as a result of the cyclone, and what started as a natural disaster has turned into a man-made crisis.
And so where do you go from here? We've heard for days. We, of course, are talking now on day 13. It's been 13 days since Cyclone Nargis hit the country. And all we hear is about how the junta is not allowing not only aid in, but also refusing to allow international aid workers in, and that there have been negotiations going on. What did those negotiations look like? What have you heard about them?
Well, there were some negotiations at trying to let the regime sort of handpick who the aid workers would be. So the thought was that maybe if we sent in only aid workers of one race, then maybe that would be acceptable to the regime. So the latest I read this morning was that there may be approval for Asians only to enter into Burma to help the people in the cyclone region. I don't know if that's going to happen or not, but that appears what the UN may be signing off on.
I've seen reports from the State Department and the U.S. Agency for International Development saying yesterday that the crisis is so severe that they are willing to risk American aid winding up in the wrong hands or for sale to ensure that at least some of it gets through.
Yeah, I mean, this is not the right tack to take. I mean, that is exactly the problem, is that people are willing to hand over the aid to the military regime, and then it doesn't reach the people that need to have it. I mean, you're talking about a situation where 2.5 million people, there needs to be multiple flights landing every hour, a massive relief effort with hundreds, if not thousands, of aid workers, and hoping that a little bit might trickle through is not enough. What we would like to see is for countries to immediately dispatch the aid that is sitting on ships and helicopters and the cargo planes into the Delta region inside Burma over the objections of the military regime.
Well, you just brought me to my next question, is exactly how do you do that over the objections of the military rulers? And there's been reports, for example, that the police are blocking the roads that would lead to the ravaged Delta. And so, therefore, you got UN workers there who are just there to deliver food. I mean, what are they supposed to do? They're not soldiers.
Sure, sure. Well, you know, this is the world what wrung its hands and expressed its collective guilt and frustration after 800,000 people were killed by, you know, in a war and genocide in Rwanda in 1994. And that was supposed to be a seminal moment in our history in which the world came together and through the UN afterwards pledged that when millions faced death in the future, there would be humanitarian intervention.
Well, Jeremy, you use the Rwanda situation, but let's focus on this particular regime. And we spoke with someone from the World Food Program this morning who's talking with lower-level officials. Mm-hmm. They're standing at checkpoints. Mm-hmm. They appear to have no clout. He candidly admitted that Ban Ki-moon, the Secretary General, is being ignored by the Myanmar regime. I mean, does this regime have any sort of military power? Is there a scenario where you could bypass them?
Yeah, exactly. There is, because the Delta region that's been hardest hit is not an area that's heavily populated by troops of the military regime. The U.S., the French, and the British navies all have ships, helicopters, and supplies sitting right offshore. They're just sitting there while people are dying. And what we're saying is they should go into this rural Delta region, not into the capital and not into the largest city, and stop airdropping supplies and finding other alternatives to get relief directly to the people. The military is not going to let these unarmed UN and other aid workers do their job.
Jeremy, often airdrops are very unreliable as a way of reaching people. In the Delta region, is there something other than simply dropping food by air that would get to more people?
Yeah, I mean, I think you really need to get people on the ground delivering the aid, which means the militaries of these countries. I mean, there's 11,000 troops just sitting there waiting. They need to go into this region and start delivering supplies. I mean, this is a type of scenario they could deliver supplies in the morning and leave at night. I mean, they don't need to stay there. They don't need to occupy in any way at all. Airdrops are really not a good scenario, but it is the last possible scenario, and we're getting to that point where we need to start looking.
Jeremy, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we're running out of time. Just really quickly, and who should be the international body to lead that effort? Is it the UN? Is it the U.S.? Is it someone else? And you have about 10 seconds.
There's zero chance that the UN will do it, because China has already said they will veto any initiative by the UN to do this. So it'll have to be countries such as India, Thailand, the U.S., France, that are willing to do so, that already have assets right there offshore.
Jeremy Woodrum, director of the U.S. Campaign for Burma, thanks so much.
And ASEAN, the Regional Security Agency, involving some of those countries that were mentioned by Jeremy, has taken some action this morning, but it's very, very, very limited.
It's so complicated and so desperate. We'll be back.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. Around the world today, it's estimated that 120 million blogs will begin.
Is that right?
Yeah, it's not clear how many of them will be updated anytime soon, but that's how many people are entering the internet space to contribute, to publish. We are asking the question today on The Takeaway, what activity makes your day complete? My day is not complete unless I do blank.
Hello, my name is Vincent Williams. I'm calling from Philadelphia, and my day is not complete unless I check all of my various and sundry news sources and my bank account online.
What we're talking about is how much of people's lives have moved online and why, and what it is they're not doing that they were doing before. How many Wikipedia projects could you work on in the time that you used to watch television? Well, joining us is Clay Shirky, who wrote the book Here Comes Everybody, The Power of Organizing Without Organizations. He's on the faculty of NYU. In your book, Clay, you seem to be suggesting that there's a giant realignment going on in the free time of all of us. Our inner free time is changing from one activity to another. How's that going? How's that taking place?
The realignment is really a kind of a carving out of what I've been calling a cognitive surplus, right? We've had all of this free time given to us by the restructuring of industrial society, right? Starting in the 1950s, there was lots and lots of time in society as a whole to do new things. And mostly what we did for 50 years was watch television. And what we're starting to see is that people are adopting more interactive ways of using the time. Some of it's quite, you know, it's not all for the social good. A lot of it's playing Grand Theft Auto 4 or trading cute pictures of cats online.
But it's still, it's a shift from passive media to active media.
Right. It's all about engagement. And this, I think, is the big shift, right? We've, in the 20th century, particularly in the second half of the 20th century, media was run as a single race. It was all about consume. How much can people consume? And the answer turned out to be quite a lot, about 20 hours a week of television on average.
I think you actually said that folks in the U.S. watch 200 billion hours of TV a year.
Yes,
I found that just shocking.
And that's just the adults.
How many billion hours do we have in America?
I know. Well,
what we're seeing is that people don't just like to consume. Of course, they like to consume, but they also like to produce and they like to share. And so what we're seeing is not a replacement of the old model with the new model. People are still watching television, certainly. But they're also able to engage with one another. And in fact, this isn't just, you know, not stopping watching TV and starting watching GTA 4. There are all of these media properties now, like Lost, like Heroes, where the people who are watching them are also engaging with one another.
So it's passive and active together.
Right.
Let's talk about Wikipedia for a second.
Interesting, but hold on, just a quick follow-up on that, which is you're talking about those communities that are created by the networks who develop these shows. Is that what you mean? Or people creating their own blogs or websites and engaging in conversation about their characters, storylines, and so on.
It's actually a mix, and the really smart media properties are providing a platform, but letting the users actually decide what to do with it.
Yeah, actually, the networks are tempted to try to control everything, but they can't. That's
right.
Really the lesson again
that's
and
right.
again and again. Well, what about Wikipedia? Because that's something that can't exist without interactivity. How much time is spent on Wikipedia?
I sort of batted some numbers around with Martin Wattenberg at IBM, who's a researcher at IBM, has spent quite a lot of time looking at Wikipedia. And the estimate we've come up with for the entire Wikipedia project, which is to say all articles and edits in all languages, is something like 100 million hours of human thought, right?
Wow.
And that seems like an enormous number. It is an enormous number compared to any individual's contribution.
A little out of context, though.
But when you compare it to the fact that we watch 100 million hours of ads on television in the U.S. alone every weekend, suddenly the Wikipedia scale doesn't seem so large.
That's really free labor, right?
Exactly. So the question is it free labor or is it something – I mean, it looks like free labor if you're comparing Wikipedia to another encyclopedia that does it for, you know, does it for profit, whether World Book
Britannica or what have you.
But, you know, when you go to a bar, right, it's interesting to be in the bar, and it's interesting because the other people are there. Do you say that's free labor? No, it's in fact people doing something that they find engaging.
Like paying the bartender. Yeah.
It's a different transaction taking place there.
But. You're really losing me on that analogy.
Well, let's back up for a second. What is being mobilized, though? Do people have an innate need to connect once the platform exists? Do these communities spontaneously come into existence because there's a real need for people to get it right on Wikipedia?
Absolutely. And in fact, it's not even once the platform exists. It's people have a need to connect, period. We are social animals, right? So tools don't cause these things to happen. They just enable them.
Clay Shirky, we're going to come back to that in the rest of the hour. Clay Shirky is the author of Here Comes Everybody. And here comes Femi Oke with more headlines.
Thanks, John. Making news at 26 minutes past the hour in the nation today. John McCain is in Ohio talking about his vision for a McCain administration. And Barack Obama basks in the support of John Edwards. Elsewhere around the world, we're getting news this hour from China's official state television service. It's reporting that China's government believed that the earthquake that hit earlier this week could result in a death toll of 50,000 people. Authorities have asked the public to donate equipment for the rescue effort. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez is warning Colombia that a continued U.S. military presence near the two countries' border will create instability. Colombia officials accuses President Chavez of helping rebel groups in their country. And while Israel is celebrating its anniversary, Palestinians are commemorating the 60th anniversary of a day they call Nakba, or catastrophe. The BBC's Alan Makbul has more.
A lot of the surviving refugees and their descendants still live in camps scattered around the region. They'll hold protest marches across the Palestinian territories. Some will display old deeds and keys to homes now occupied by Israel.
In 1948, hundreds of thousands of Arabs left or fled their homes and Palestine in what had been Palestine when the State of Israel was created. And the day will also be marked by the release of thousands of black balloons. A little-known militant group has said it was responsible for bomb attacks in the Indian city of Jaipur on Wednesday, which killed at least 60 people and injured 200 others. The group, called Indian Mujahideen, sent an email to national media. The police are investigating their claim. And finally, the earthquake in China has forced attention on predicting seismic events from signs in nature. As rescue and recovery efforts continue there have been a number of very interesting animal anecdotes. For instance, zoo animals were said to have behaved strangely. A pond drained out and toads have been seen leaping across the streets. I know Japan has done some very groundbreaking research when it comes to forecasting earthquakes, but most seismologists say that it's actually impossible to predict earthquakes.
Well, I love the stories, though. You always hear them, that the sheep come together at one side of the pen just before an earthquake.
But, and you remember the tsunami? A lot of animals actually went uphill, away
from
the coast.
Smart animals. It was so tragic because so many of the people, as the water went out, went down.
And the animals went up the hill.
Yeah.
They knew their stuff.
Well, they had more genetic experience, evolutionary experience with tsunamis. Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, now featuring Mandy and Lester, a short film about a girl who loses two boxes of Scout cookies, a boy who finds those cookies, and who finds that returning them isn't going to be as simple as it seems. Available at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. The death toll continues to climb in China and Sichuan province from Monday's earthquake. 19,500 is the latest estimate from Chinese state media. Also, the nature of this tragedy and how it bears on individual families on the ground in China is also becoming more and more clear as we see survivors pulled from the rubble and people who didn't make it. Jim Yardley from The New York Times spoke with us earlier this week as the devastation was beginning to unfold. He spent yesterday at a school in Zhuhuan, China, where parents watched as their children were pulled from the rubble. Jim, thanks for joining us. You write this morning about the particular pain of families seeing their children as part of the death toll of this tragedy. What did you see yesterday?
Well, yesterday I spent 16 hours, I would say, traveling all over the region, and at about 1 o'clock in the morning, I went to a morgue on the outskirts of the city of Dujiangyan, which is a city where six or seven schools collapsed, and we went into the morgue, and it was unlike anything I'd ever seen. It was nearly 2 o'clock in the morning, and the parking lot was filled, and there were scores upon scores of bodies of young children covered in sheets, and they were the victims who had been pulled from the schools of the city, and their parents were there with them, and they were burning incense or crying, and they were waiting to have their children cremated. They had come to the morgue to identify the children. And obviously, in a country where most families can only have one child, this is a doubly devastating event, and some of the parents were beyond grief, and they were also quite angry because they were angry at local officials on the school. They accused the local officials of responding too slowly in rescue efforts at the school. They also accused them of shoddy construction, which has become an increasingly big issue here in China as we're seeing that more and more schools are being destroyed, as other buildings are not, in this tragedy.
Beyond the grief, you think that this is going to be an issue going forward, the question of construction, particularly of schools where young children have been so many victims?
Well, I mean, the big story is still obviously the massive mobilization and the response and the effort to get to people. But we are beginning to see in some of the state media even editorials saying that there needs to be an examination of the quality of school construction. You know, the expansion of education in China has been going on for the past decade, and there have been various government programs to build rural schools. But, of course, local corruption is endemic in China, and there have always been allegations about siphoning off money and using cheaper-grade cement and concrete, and I fear that we're beginning to see some of the residue of that right now. So I would not at all be surprised if this becomes a political issue here in China.
Just a few seconds, Jim. The heavy equipment is starting to get into the worst affected areas. The recovery is proceeding. Is that what you understand?
Yeah, we're up to about 100,000 troops and other rescue workers, almost as many troops as America has in Iraq. So it's an enormous effort. However, this is an incredibly mountainous area, and one of the things to keep in mind is even though so much attention is being focused on areas like Wenchuan and Beichuan, which are the more populated, there are hundreds of other towns and cities in these mountains where little rescue efforts have gotten there. So
challenges
this is
ahead,
be a tough
definitely.
Job.
Challenges ahead. Jim Yardley, thank you very much for joining us. Jim Yardley of The New York Times. Adora?
Adding to the rising death toll, Chinese officials are reporting a dam in the devastated region of Sichuan, where Jim is, required repairs by Chinese troops. Aftershocks have demolished buildings and triggered landslides, making rescue efforts even more difficult. Chinese people around the world are, of course, as we can imagine, frantic for information about loved ones or just mourning their country. Trying to find out what's happening, many have turned to the community online, many posting on the BBC's Chinese language website. Britt Yip is an online news producer there. Britt, there are Chinese expatriates all over the world. You're seeing information of all kinds. How big of a wave is this?
So far, well, since Monday evening, London time, we have received, in our Chinese website, we have received more than 600 emails. And on the English websites, they have received more than 1,100 emails. Most of them are basically talking about their concern for how the government is going to help so many victims, and also how they're going to react to this massive scale of
could you actually share one of the emails with us,
yes.
One or two of them?
Yes, one of these emails from a Chinese student living in Seattle. He said, I would like to show my great sympathy and grief for the people living in the earthquake zone, and we hope the government would do their utmost best to help them, and also the international world will help them. Another one from Sydney. This one is a Chinese migrant in Sydney, and he said, well, I have been trying for the past 2 days to try to get hold of my friends and families in Chengdu, which is the capital of Sichuan province, but the communication doesn't seem to be back on normal, and I am very worried. I have grave concern for two of my cousins living very close to the epic center. And there is another email from a Taiwan student. He is living in London, and he says, this is the time that Chinese communities around the world should pull together, and also it is the moment for the Chinese and the Taiwanese government to put aside their political differences and to help to save as many lives as possible.
Britt Yip, online news producer for BBC Radio, thank you. Time now for more headlines from Femi Oke.
It's 21 minutes to the hour, and more thunderstorms are expected in Shreveport, Louisiana. The city and surrounding areas have been swamped by more than 10 inches of rain since late Tuesday, and nearly half of the rain fell in a single hour. At least 90 homes were flooded and roads have been closed. Ohio's attorney general has resigned due to a sexual harassment investigation in his office and his admission that he had an extramarital affair. Mark Dan has been under pressure of possible impeachment and announced that he was stepping down yesterday. The 46-year-old Democrat at first refused to resign. In the NBA, the Boston Celtics moved within a one victory of the Eastern Conference Finals, and the Celtics beat Cleveland Cavaliers to take a 3-2 series lead. Cavaliers superstar LeBron James led all the scorers with 35 points.
We just got to approach it like any other game, like you're down 0-2. And we got to approach it that way. We're a very good team at home. But a LeBron James team is never desperate.
Like the takeaway team. Game 6 is in Cleveland on Friday night. I think I fit there. And if they need a deciding game, it will be played
cry for help
on there. Sunday in Boston.
Thank you, Femi. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
So the march goes on in the NBA Finals.
What's yes.
You're going to make predictions? Because you love to do that. I despise predictions, but I know that you enjoy them thoroughly.
I say Celtics-Lakers.
And who wins, Celtics or Lakers?
Ooh, that's hard. That's hard. Kobe will be really stepping up for that. That'll be hard. I don't know. I won't go there. Maybe later. Maybe next week.
We'll see.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. We're talking about how posting online has become an event in people's lives, and we're also talking about how events, world events, cause people to create communities using these platforms. Clay Shirky is with us. He's the author of Here Comes Everybody, The Power of Organizing Without Organizations. Interesting that a disaster, Clay, brings people together. They immediately know that there's a platform to go through. It's almost as though they're answering the call from the BBC, which, of course, is a reliable character, a voice out there of news and stability.
I think this is one of the really big transformations in media right now. Media is going from being a source of information to being a site of action, where people gather to a place, and now they're not just looking to see what the BBC knows, they're also sharing what they know.
But, you know, listen to this, though. Here is how the actual aftermath of the earthquake is not simply a story of survival, but it's a story to get access
yes.
to world information. Here's someone by the name of Estan Du. He's a 20-year-old student in Chengdu. We contacted him. He had posted on the BBC site. Here's his story of how he got out of the rubble.
After the
earthquake, we were sent out to open ground and forbidden to enter any buildings. But I later, about 5 hours later, I managed to get into one of the computer rooms and logged into the internet. And I start twittering and blogging about big events.
The earthquake happened. Estandu says, "I'm a reporter." He goes to find a computer. Isn't that interesting?
Yep. And when you see, I mean, he mentioned Twitter, which is this service for rebroadcasting messages. And Twitter, the so-called Twitter sphere, was alight with information. But it wasn't just information. Joey Ito, a friend of mine, was talking about the quake. And he was also putting out URLs and a plea for help. So he was giving people both information that this had happened and said, donate here.
And you know what's also really fascinating when you take a look at how people are participating in this? Let's take a listen to Richard Bradbury. He works in Beijing for China Radio International. And here's what he told the BBC about what kind of information is coming out.
You're seeing a lot of pictures that maybe wouldn't be shown on the mainstream media, and a lot of people commenting about that, passing them through on various social media platforms like Twitter and like MSN. And I think it's because of some of these images that are really encouraging people to start donating and to make contact with people who are down there, or try and make contact with people down there. It's images that we generally wouldn't see on the Chinese, you know, television.
So one person's action of putting these things online leads to another person's action, which is donating now that they've seen, they've had a window into the devastation that they did not have before.
Yeah. There's also this pattern of mass amateurization, right? At the same time, the Chinese government is saying only the Xinhua News Agency is allowed to send reporters. QQ, which is one of the Chinese, a very large Chinese internet service, is alight with not just photos but video. There are enough people with video camera phones that there are actually news clips streaming out of China.
So the way we get a picture of events is now sort of coalescing and coming into focus on all of these screens rather than just one or two screens.
Bingo.
Our takeaway question for today is, my day is not complete until I've blanked online. You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age. Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. We're going to revisit the food story. The price of food, of course, in all kinds of commodities has reached records and is responsible for the food inflation that was reported yesterday from the CPI statistics that came out. But we're going to talk about salmon
fishing.
Consumer
price index.
Yeah, consumer price index.
Right.
CPI. I can't do acronyms.
No, but sometimes I have to think too hard. You should just explain
MZQ.
To me what that is.
MZQ.
I don't know.
QNX. All right. No, we're going to move away from acronyms and go straight to fishing. Salmon fishing. The news about the price of salmon is actually pretty grim because the populations of salmon have collapsed off the Pacific coast. But there's one bit of good news if you're interested in wild salmon. In Alaska, the fish are jumping. The profits could be high. $35 a pound for wild Copper River salmon, and one of the largest harvests in nearly 50 years is expected this year. Fishmonger and seasoned salmon fisher Jason Headland will be getting in on the salmon action next month at the Bristol Bay Run, where it's expected that 40 million sockeye salmon are expected to swim upstream. Jason will be among them. Jason, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, how are you doing?
So you're going on a little field trip, I guess, huh?
Yeah. It's kind of rite of summer passage, and taking like a 3-year hiatus and be going back this summer to get back into it.
Why is the population so high in the run this year?
There's no perfect science to predicting these runs. It seems like for this year in particular, the winters, they had, you know, fairly mild winters, mild springs, which helped the smolt out through, you know, that phase of their life. So there's a lot of smolt leaving the rivers this time of year. And then when it gets time for those fish to return, if there was a lot more of them going out, there'll be a lot more of them coming back.
And there are a few dams on the river system in Alaska where you're headed, correct?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And I think that's one of the major things that the Alaska salmon fishery has going for is the watersheds that the salmon reproduce in and thrive in. They've just had really little impact through logging, through hydroelectric damming, and, you know, pulling water for irrigation and stuff, which is what you've seen a lot in the West Coast.
Now, my fishmonger last night at the Fairway store here in Brooklyn was telling me that Copper River salmon are sweeter and they're much better wild than farmed. Is that your impression?
I would have to say, yeah, I'd have to agree. They are one of the best-tasting salmon that you'll find on the plate. You're going to pay a pretty penny for them. But
$35 a pound, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Sockeye, I mean, we don't have a fixed price from just yet. The season's opening, you know, 7 o'clock a.m. Alaska time this morning. But, yeah, the sockeye will probably be about mid-30s. And kings are definitely going to start in the $40 range.
How important is this, Ron? I mean, we've seen some reporting about last month commercial salmon fisheries in California and Oregon were shut down, as John mentioned. I mean, how critical is this to the salmon industry this year?
I think this is really going to bring a lot of exposure to Alaska salmon. I mean, folks have been reading the headlines, and I think there's just this general concern now for wild salmon as a whole. But what people need to take into account and really remember is that, you know, and for the most part, most of the not wild salmon that we see here in North America that's harvested domestically, you know, at least 90% or greater comes from Alaska. So the focus, you know, they shouldn't really, you know, be too wary of, you know, when you see wild salmon in a case, you know, just, you know, ask the right questions, find out where it's coming from. And if it's Alaskan, you can feel really confident about buying it. And I think that's going to, you know, drive people even more so to ask those questions.
Good advice from Jason Hedlund, who's a fishmonger. We should point out he's a fishmonger at the multi-billion dollar Whole Foods, which is based in Austin, Texas, which is where Jason is speaking to us from. Although he's going off to experience the 40 million sockeye salmon run this year on his own dime as a bit of a three-year sabbatical. Jason, thanks for joining us. Jason Hedlund, he's headed to Alaska next month. Have fun. Don't fall off the boat.
$35 a pound sounds like a lot to me.
Copper River, it's tasty.
It's tasty.
I don't know if it's worth it, but it's tasty.
It's tasty. All right. From salmon to all sorts of records in the presidential campaign, we've been talking about them, how much each candidate, how much money they've raised. We've talked about how many voters have turned out. But you may not know one thing. It's also a record year for paraphernalia collectors.
You're making a segue from salmon to bumper stickers?
I am.
That is awesome.
Well, because there's
lots.
Can
I say that is awesome?
There's lots and lots. And we're going to turn to Mark Evans, who is an official with the American Political Items Collectors Organization. Yes, that does exist. Mark, for you, what's made this year so intriguing?
Hi. Well, one of the differences this year has been that there are no incumbents in the race. We have two wide open nominations on both sides of the field. So, as you know, there were at least 18 major presidential candidates competing, each one generating bumper stickers, signs, buttons, and the memorabilia promoting their candidacies.
Mark, how much are those Duncan Hunter T-shirts going for, babe?
Oh, I think... they probably totally disappeared from the marketplace.
Would you say disappeared? But I know what hasn't disappeared. That is paraphernalia for Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. I just want to share something with you. This morning I did a quick search on eBay, and there was very interesting how close this was. But Barack Obama, there was 2729 entries for him, so 2,729. Mm-hmm. And for Hillary Clinton, she was leading 2,784. So she got him by about 50 items or so. What's the most unusual tchotchke you've seen this year?
Well, the most unusual thing that was given away was during the Iowa caucuses. The Clinton campaign gave away these blue plastic megaphones that contained popcorn. And it was similar to what you might buy years ago in Yankee Stadium after you ate your popcorn. You'd take the cap off the small end, and you could use the container for a megaphone. And it said something like Boosting Hillary. There was some slogan on the side of it.
So are the campaigns getting creative as to what they're offering?
No, the campaigns are usually pretty dull and boring. it's the private vendors that get creative, that sell to the general public at rallies and events and parades.
You've created a whole new way of evaluating the candidates. I mean, we've been talking this entire election about electability, but you're talking about collectability.
That's right.
Who's the most collectible candidate in your view, Mark? You're the expert.
You mean for this campaign?
Yeah, for 08.
Well, probably Obama and Hillary are at the top, with McCain coming up third, I would think.
What about Ron Paul? Kind of bizarre, kind of obscure, but still has a big following?
Yes, he still has a big following. And in my travels, I see more Ron Paul signs out in the environment than any other candidate.
And you make a really interesting point, which is because it's gone on for so long, it's like encouraged all kinds of creativity by the vendors, as you've said, over a longer period of time, which is why we're ending up with far more different kinds of trinkets than we have ever had.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a way to collect a complete set of every piece of junk generated by the 08 campaign?
Well, first of all, it's not junk. This is
a part of America's precious legacy. Yes. Precious American legacy.
No, there really is no way to get it all, and that's what makes it such a wonderful hobby, because anyone can make something, any committee, any group, any vendor. And I collect material going all the way back to the 19th century, and I regularly see presidential memorabilia that I've never seen before. And you don't have this thing happening in other hobbies like stamps and coins, right, where everything is cataloged and known.
Well, Mark Evans, we're going to be looking out with a bit of a closer eye on the collectibles as we move forward with this primary process that is not over yet. So Mark Evans, veteran collector and member services director of the National Organization, American Political Items Collectors, we thank you.
You're welcome.
Oh, it's a banner year. And online, Clay, is probably a great place to monitor where all this stuff is going and its value.
Yeah, and eBay, in fact, may turn out to be an upside-down indicator. It may be that more things are listed on eBay after people are getting rid of their campaign stuff.
Oh, that's
so
interesting.
Maybe like
point.
A golf score, higher is worse. We don't know.
Right. So it's that is interesting. So people are dumping Edwards' stuff a week later?
There will be people using eBay as an outlet for first sales, and then there will be people reselling stuff that they had and are now getting rid of. And so unpacking that is going to be, you know, It's a complicated metric.
How much of your life is online, Clay, before we
end? less now than it used to be. It's funny. I was in the 90s. I was absolutely addicted, and I use the word advisedly.
In the 90s, Clay, that's like a long time ago.
That was
so
last century.
Last 8 years, you haven't been online.
No. Not as much. I got married and then had kids, and so more of my life moved offline as it would with.
Yeah. Clay Shirky, author of Here Comes Everybody. Thanks for joining us here in the studio, and you know, our lives are completely offline. We're in a radio studio.
Yeah, but we have two monitors in front of us, so we're always up to date
as
to what's happening online. But we want you to keep your responses coming to us. Today's takeaway question is, my day is not complete until I've done what online? You can contact us at thetakeaway.org, or you can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Clay Shirky, of course, so you can hear more from him on our website. We have a video that's posted on thetakeaway.org, a lecture that he gave, I believe, at Harvard.
Yeah, it was at Harvard. You're right.
And also, we're marking a big anniversary this week, folks. The cubicle is turning 40. If you're sitting in your cubicle now, you're obviously working the early shift. Tell us about your cubicle life. Send us a photo. My take at thetakeaway.org. We have a slideshow of the best of them on Friday.
Yeah, that coming
Anything
up.
More?
And
Anymore?
Yeah, just very quickly, there's history at the historically black Morehouse College. This Sunday, a white student will give the valedictorian address for the first time.
Oh, we're going to cover that.
In the college's history. So look out for that.
Takeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its American Worker Initiative. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.